Why do more media professionals read iwantmedia.com? iwantmedia.com features reports from industry leaders and media personalities. iwantmedia.com gives you quick access to news, stats, trade orgs, and industry publications, and it's updated daily. Forbes says iwantmedia.com contains everything media professionals need to stay ahead of the game. The Washington Post calls it the source for the serious media geek. Do you get it? If you don't, you should. To sign up for free daily email alerts, visit iwantmedia.com.
Welcome to The Advertising Show, America's only radio program focusing on advertising, media, marketing, product development, branding, new media, sales and customer relations. Stay with us for entertaining marketing discussion and our special guest interview. Now, here are your hosts, Ray Schillens and Brad Forsythe.
So glad you're here to join us today on The Advertising Show with Ray Schillens and Brad Forsythe, being brought to you by Advertising Age Magazine. You can visit online at adage.com, The Advertising Show, a copyrighted Big Radio Midgets production. We've got a great show for you today. We've got Rob Scalea out of New York, and we'll tell you a little bit more about Rob. He's the CEO of the Brand Union North America. It's part of WPP, where he spearheads innovative approaches, it says here, to delivering effective brand management solutions for clients. Good plan. And we're going to get a chance to meet and find out more about Rob here at the Advertising Show. Jeremy Kent is with us here just momentarily. Jeremy is, if you're a regular follower of the show, is our European correspondent. And interesting thing going on over there this week. The Formula One race is big and very big over in Britain. And they've got a bunch of sponsors. They've got all different kinds of sponsors. And what they're doing now is they're all coming together to act as one unified sponsor. Now, in my mind, I'm thinking that's going to be some headaches down the road, but we'll see what happens. Jeremy, in just a little while here at the Advertising Show. So glad you're here. Brett, you've got something there.
Yeah, I'd like to welcome a new sponsor. Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, where you'll find over 75,000 titles to choose from for your iPod or MP3 player. And just for you, our listeners at the Advertising Show, Audible is offering a free audio download along with a free 14-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. Audible.com has available many of the business titles of the authors we feature here on the Advertising Show, as well as current releases, the New York Times bestsellers, arts and entertainment, fiction, nonfiction, all of the categories of books you might find at your local bookstore are available at Audible.com. So to get your free audiobook download and begin your free 14-day trial, simply go to audiblepodcast.com/adshow. Again, that's audiblepodcast.com/adshow. And sign up today. And while you're at it, tell a friend about the Advertising Show's free 14-day trial offer and welcome audible.com.
For a limited time, member FDIC.
And so you don't forget mail before midnight.
You use with caution. Yes. Well, actually, that'd be really pertinent for the Advertising Show, wouldn't it,
I guess? Actually, you know, I was on there, and when you look at the business titles, and they have it very easily to navigate on their site, but when you go to their site and you look at their business titles, there are a lot of former guests here on the Advertising Show. So when you hear something you like and you want to go check it out, go to, as I said, audiblepodcast.com/adshow, and what's better than free, right, Ray?
There is nothing better than free. Like the Groupon people found it. Have you seen the interesting twist? Groupon is a coupon service. They say it is not designed to generate ROI. It is designed to generate buzz, and that is what they do. This Groupon thing has, in some cases, backfired on some of the folks. There was a helicopter school that wanted to advertise a $79 flight. This is like half their flight, normal cost of the flight. And they went to Groupon, and of course Groupon did an email blast and all the other things that they do. And the first day of the promotion, the first morning, instead of getting a couple hundred, they got a couple thousand people wanting to go for a helicopter ride. And here's the problem. they don't have enough helicopters to engage all of these people. So what happens? You end up pissing off your clients or your potential clients because you can't deliver the product. So
did they have enough sense to limit the offer, or did they screw up and not put a limit on it?
There was no limit, and that's the way Groupon works, apparently. Come get them. And it's worked for some major advertisers as well, that apparently they're doing that now as well. But how interesting. And it just drives the point home. There was a local venue that did the Groupon thing. It was a nail place or whatever. An oil change place. That's what it was. And, you know, first of all, Groupon takes half your sale. So if you're charging $15, they get $7, you make $7. You're not making money. You're losing money at this point. But here's the hitch. If you do not have the capability to carry these people who are coming your way via Groupon, you might as well just hang up, you know, close up shop and take your shingle somewhere else, because you have now effectively shot yourself in the foot. So there's got to be an upside to this, but as advertisers, look for these things. You know, this is not necessarily, may not necessarily be for you, or maybe it is, but you've got to be able to service your clients. So it's an interesting process. It's funny, I was on the internet earlier today, and also saw one of the ads for Groupon as well, as it relates to restaurants. So there's another potential fiasco as it goes. Let me talk a little bit here too, as we get into Jeremy Kent, about our guest today, and it's Rob Scalia out of New York. As we said, he's the CEO of the Brand Union North America. He's also worked a 6-year tenure at fellow WPP agency JWT as a chief strategy officer, where he developed business and marketing strategy practices that help clients grow their revenue and profit through increased understanding of their target audiences, new product development, distribution strategies, repositioning exercises, sounds like yoga, improved marketing ROI, and strategic business planning. He's also been actively involved with clients in complex and often volatile industries. I wonder if that was BP by any chance, such as healthcare, financial services, and technology. So Rob's work ranges from major brands to more future-focused entrepreneurial assignments as well. He would be a good one to tap for the Virgin Atlantic space travel thing. I think that'd be a really cool thing to have on board as well. And speaking of Britain, what a transition. Jeremy Kent is with us, our European correspondent on the advertising show, as we get some the skinny on Formula One racing and the folks behind it, the advertisers. Let's listen.
Hi, and welcome to London and the European News Desk. I'm Jeremy Kent. This week, F1 sponsors form an alliance, Gap fills a hole in online shopping, and Google's logo is number one in the UK. For the first time, the money behind Formula One has a unified voice. The sport's top 100 sponsors have come together and created a new body called F100 to represent their interests. Together, the sponsors invest around $720 million a year in the world's premier motorsport series. The first meeting of the new organisation took place in London on the 1st of September, with LG, SAP and Shell setting the agenda, while representatives of the F1 teams were also in attendance. F100, which also represents Puma, Vodafone, Diageo and others, aims to meet three times a year at the start, middle and end of each season. F1 Supremo Bernie Eccleston has promised to review the minutes of each meeting. Gap, the US clothing retailer, is a well-established brand in the UK, but until a few days ago, it did not have an online store from which to serve UK customers. Now, shoppers can buy online from both Gap and its Banana Republic brands over the internet. The service is launched just days ahead of Zara, a Spanish fashion retailer which is also prominent on the UK high street. Zara has offered homewares online for some time, but from the 2nd of September its clothing range can also be found online. H&M isn't far behind either and will be offering homewares online from September 16th. Now, most people might guess that Google's logo is number one for visibility, but new research from myvouchercodes.co.uk has quantified and confirmed it. On average, the logo is seen once every 9 minutes. 34% of respondents said Google was the logo they saw most on an average day, with 47% of those saying it was their homepage. Overall, more than 52% of respondents said that they used Google to search for something around 10 to 20 times a day. Microsoft was the second most viewed logo, polling 15%, followed by Facebook with 11% and Apple with 9%. After these prominent techno-internet brands, Coca-Cola makes it to a well-earned fifth place, with 8% of respondents saying they see it most during the day, Indeed, it's the only brand in the top 10 that isn't from the media and technology sector, and that really says something about Coke's marketing. This is Jeremy Kent at the European News Desk for The Advertising Show.
Hey, thanks, Jeremy. Jeremy Kent on The Advertising Show, our European correspondent. Always a great feature and always great to have Jeremy part of the show. We told you about Rob Scalea, and right now we get a chance to meet him. Rob is in New York this weekend, and Rob, hey, thanks for being here at The Advertising Show. We appreciate you dropping by.
My pleasure.
Yeah, and you know, according to your bio, you know this, but our audience doesn't. You graduated from MIT with a molecular biology background. I'm sure having a science background obviously came in handy with your healthcare and Pharmco clients, but I'm curious, Rob, what was the transition like from MIT to Madison Avenue?
I don't think that's a possibility of doing that.
It's not really a straight line. I will tell you that right away.
You had to go to Peoria first.
That's right. Well, you know, I will just pick up on something else, something you said before I even answer the question, which is, on the one hand, I think certainly a degree in science and engineering was really helpful for a number of industries that are related. It also, though, was a great background for lots of different industries, just to have an analytical bent and be able to deal with complexity, because lots of industries these days are very complex. And so I've always found that it's been helpful to me. My first job out of university was actually for a very small company that was involved in, it was a computer graphics and molecular modeling company. So having the engineering background was science background was a very helpful thing. But we were so small, and we grew into a lot of needs for marketing, and I just happened to be there and more than willing to pick up the slack. And so it was great training for me, and really demonstrated the power of communications in a company's success.
So I take it you don't miss the, I don't know, however you would want to characterize the world of MIT and science and all that stuff, and versus the excitement of Madison Avenue?
Well, you know, I will say I have been really enjoying my career and the time on Madison Avenue, as you say. I still do remain involved in a number of technology initiatives, serve on boards of companies, and try to keep my hand on a little science and engineering. It happens to be a very exciting field as well.
And the folks there say you still wear a white lab coat to work every day. Rob, you've got to drop that. Let go of the past, Rob.
Yeah, no, it's been a hard process, but I'm getting there.
Good for you.
Well, one of your clients, the House of Barbie, recently opened in Shanghai, and as we've seen, there are more and more companies today trying to create more engaging consumer experiences with their brand. Nike and the Apple Store are two that happen to come to mind for me. And the idea is all about creating a new retail concept to extend one's brand. Tell us, Rob, a little bit about the House of Barbie and what your firm's role was and what their goals were, et cetera.
Great. Well, it was a major initiative for us. It's a flagship store in Shanghai. And as you say, really, the charge was to look at the totality of the experience with the brand, with the product itself, and really expand people's views of what the brand can represent. So as it turns out, I don't remember the exact percentage, but I think it's on the order of only 20% of the store is actually devoted to the doll and related products. There are restaurants, there are food and beverages, there are fashion departments. It's a much more, it is a brand extension that has been very successful for them. Obviously, the flagship store concept itself is very important for the aura or halo that it creates around the brand for those people just buying the traditional products as well.
Do you see this as a trend? I mean, you know, not so many years ago, I guess, I don't really remember when, but back at least 10 years ago, I remember going to San Francisco into the Nike Experience store. And of course, more recently, Ray mentioned a few shows ago about Apple finally getting over to London to open one of their Apple stores that you have there in Manhattan. Is this something that we're going to see more and more of, or is this maybe just a flash in the pan, do you think?
I think you're going to see more and more of it. I think you're going to see more and more of it from brands that have strong associations and brand equity already associated with them. And I think it's a great platform because, A, for those people who experience the store, it obviously propagates the brand and the desire to purchase, but the public relations around it, the almost out-of-home advertising-like concept. Anybody who's driving by the Apple Store in New York, those stores are so well-designed that from the moment you see them to, certainly shopping in them, it really owns a brand experience for you.
You know, is this all about the Internet? I mean, I'm thinking that if the Internet didn't exist, maybe this idea of wanting to reconnect with today's consumer wouldn't have been as prominent as it has become. Is there a concern on corporate America's part that they need to get back to connecting with their consumer? I mean, you can buy an iPod online, you can buy Nike product online, you can buy most product online without ever even seeing it, three-dimensionally in person. So is that what role has the Internet had on this concept?
I think they are definitely interrelated. One of the things that having been in the business for a while now that you see is that a lot of times marketers will try to segment their distribution to a specific part of their target audience makeup. So, it's as simple as things like in the banking industry where banks in the early days would think that private bankers were for wealthy people, and in the early days, ATMs were for less affluent people. Well, of course, we all use ATMs. We all use lots of different channels nowadays to reach out and find the products that we're looking for. So I think that the interesting piece is not only that all of these channels exist, but that they're all interrelated, and that you need the continuity across the brand experience regardless of what channel you're using.
I agree with it. It's interesting that you say that. I often say the home office is a similar situation. 20 years ago, if you had a home office, you had one because that's all you had, and you really wanted a real office. And now today, if you don't have a home office, you're
that would be described. That'd be described as being in between gigs, basically. Home office. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Talk a little bit. I know this is a key concept there at Brand Union where you work, the balance of art and science. Describe the need to balance art and science in brand development, Rob, and also what do you look for and how do you know when you've struck that perfect balance between art and science?
Yeah, those are great questions. Well, first of all, the notion of balancing art and science, I think, has certainly been around for a while, and I think people in the industry have talked about it, but I think it keeps on taking on more and more meaning. So certainly the science piece is understanding our clients' businesses at a very analytical level. Understanding the intricacies of it, understanding the purchase cycle that people go through, and what the competition is doing, all the sort of normal things you would look at as it relates to the marketplace, the competition, the consumer, the client. The art piece, of course, is the creative expression of whatever positioning you have chosen to develop. But I will say that And so the more scientific you are, the more, quote, relevant, hopefully, the work is. And the more art-based or creative you are, the more intriguing and memorable the work is. The problem is that lots of times you will, by default, skew in one direction more than the other. And the magic or the synergy that you were talking about and how you know you've gotten it right is when you can actually fuse those things to a greater level than just one of those inputs would provide.
On the advertising show, it's Ray Schillens, Brad Forsyth, with our very special guest out of New York. Rob Scalia is Chief Executive Officer of the Brand Union North America, and thebrandunion.com is their website. On the advertising show, we'll continue the conversation here with Ray and Brad, and of course with Rob as well. Advertising show being powered by Schipul.com. It's S-C-H-I-P-U-L. And the platform is Tendency, an incredible, powerful marketing tool. So check it out here at Schipul.com. With Ray and Brad, back in just a minute with more on The Advertising Show. Rob Scalia, Ray Schillens, Brad Forsyth here at the Advertising Show. Rob is Chief Executive Officer of the Brand Union North America. It says in your bio as well that you studied at the Pasteur Institute in Paris. That's pretty cool. Was that wine studies or just regular studies?
It was. fortunately or unfortunately, I guess it was traditional studies.
Okay, and you drank your milk and felt really good there.
Exactly. Yeah,
Rob, welcome back to the show. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, Ray, thebrandunion.com is a great website. Ray and I were talking about that before you came on today. Some great case studies and some examples of some work that you guys have been doing. And we're going to talk a little bit about your Absolute Vodka product, or campaign, I should say, on a local level that you did for a Brooklyn angle to that. But before we do that, let's talk a little bit about the role of packaging design for a moment, Rob. When it comes to engaging consumers at the point of sale, there sits your product alongside with all of your major competitors within your category. I'm curious, from a package design standpoint, what can one do that gives their product an edge over their competitors as they sit side by side right there on the shelf?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. Certainly, a lot of times in a lot of categories, first of all, the packaging all looks the same. So simply having something that is unique or different alone can make a difference. But I think the bigger opportunity is to make sure that the packaging embodies and communicates the brand that you've been spending all those other dollars on through other communications. So to the extent that you can visually cue, through language cue, through shape of product or box or whatever, support the brand and the brand equities, the better off you're going to be.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Let's go back to the Absolute Brooklyn idea there that you guys, I guess that probably came from your firm, or maybe it came from your client. I'll give you a chance to explain it in a second. But there's a very interesting video posted on YouTube about this project, which shows Spike Lee, which played an important role in developing the packaging, I guess, of the Absolute Brooklyn style of brand packaging. Talk a little bit about the process and the importance of localization when it came to a product, global product for that matter, like Absolute, where the idea came from, and describe why Brooklyn.
Yep. Well, again, great question. I think what you're seeing certainly is more and more, and Absolute was certainly a pioneer in this, but as we look across different industries, you're seeing much more, to your point, localization, customization of products. We were talking about the internet earlier and the technologies and the impact they have on marketing. We are in sort of the nth degree wave of consumer empowerment, where consumers are not only weighing in now on what they want their products to look like, but they are in a lot of ways designing their products, whether that's a sneaker, whether it's a shirt, whatever. And as I say, Absolute was a real pioneer in localization. Certainly by city, but also by through holidays, through flavors and fruit flavors, et cetera, has done some very, very good work in extending the product and creating more and more niche products. And I think that that is certainly influenced by and driven by technology in a lot of ways. In the case of Absolute Brooklyn, it really was through a collaboration with Spike Lee. I think the client has been looking for opportunities for, quote, limited edition products, had struck a collaboration with Spike Lee, and we were asked to be involved for the package design to sort of bring all of the pieces together. And if you are familiar with the package, you can see we've actually incorporated a visual image of the stoop from the brownstone that Spike Lee grew up in, which was a fantastic visual device for communicating the localization piece that you were talking about.
And I've seen since then, I think I came across something that showed Boston has a version of Absolute Vodka. Did this original idea come from the client seeking you guys, or did that come from you recommending this localization idea?
Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No.
Every client is different. I will tell you, in terms of The best work and the best ideas, really, not only for the communication, but to the question you're asking for new product development itself, the best ideas come from the clients with whom we have the strongest partnerships and collaboration. And I'll tell you, sometimes it's just very hard to say that it was either the agency's idea or the client's idea. We get very heavily involved. Part of what we try to do by bringing a more strategic bent to the communications is getting involved earlier and earlier in product design, in marketing planning, in the selection of distribution channels, in identifying new target audiences. So it's hard sometimes to say, well, this came as a specific directive that we were just fulfilling a need, or to go in and try to claim 100% ownership. A lot of times it comes out of, just as I say, lots of brainstorming and good dialogue with the client.
I guess the question would beg itself to say, what is your favorite way to enjoy Absolut Vodka at this particular point, Rob?
On the rocks with a twist.
That was the right answer. Very good. Thank you. Go ahead, Brad.
Well, I was going to say, Ray and my philosophy is the same, and that is if the client is in the office, we recommend that everybody make sure and mention that it was the client's idea, and then if we're pitching new business, we make sure and let them know that it was our idea. So it really depends on who's around at
the
time.
Don't forget the award ceremonies either, okay? I think we
claim that.
That's true.
You mentioned about seeking design assistance from from your consumer. In a lot of cases, brands are so concerned about managing the touch points of their consumer, and that all throughout the process that they maintain a particular way in which the brand is represented. Yet, on the other hand, it may seem counterintuitive to many that you open up the potential of having your product designed or influenced by the very consumer that you're trying to maintain brand touch points with. Is there some conflict there in that thought process?
You know, it is a very, very good point. And certainly we're now into second and third generations of companies wrestling with this. But you can think back to earlier examples when clients were first starting to explore the idea. Clients were petrified, and rightly so, that they were relinquishing the control of their brand to their clients. To their customers. The real issue, though, what I always say is you can certainly proactively manage your brand, and that's what we're all in business for, but ultimately you are judged and measured, and your brand is evaluated and defined by what your constituent groups think. And I think what you found was, as you say, in the early days, it was a tough go, and I think there were a lot of sort of clunky and not well-executed attempts at it. Nowadays, though, if you do not, if you are not in some way engaging with your clients and making and allowing them to feel that they are contributing, you come across as inaccessible, aloof, and not a company or a brand that people want to deal with. So I don't think you really get to pick and choose. You simply have to figure out what the right way to manage it is for you and your products.
Makes a lot of sense. The Brand Union North America is part of WPP, and Robert Tillet is CEO of the brand. Here at the Advertising Show. Ray Schillens, Brad Forsyth, more to come here in just a moment. You stay right there. Go ahead. Welcome back on the Advertising Show with Ray Schillens and Brad Forsyth. Rob Scalia is our guest. Rob is CEO of the Brand Union North America. That is the Brand Union. .com, the website, if you'd like to find out more. Rob, you know, as far as a marketer or even an advertiser, a business owner, sitting here in 2010 and seeing so many things happen in front of our eyes as it relates to marketing, marketing options, what to do, what not to do. Most advertising folks have discovered the internet, and they've discovered Twitter and Facebook and such. But if you're sitting here in 2010, what should you be doing think about becoming a major player here in the next few years, 5 years or so?
I guess what I can tell you is that I think right now, we've obviously lived through a pretty difficult economic period. We're still in it. Most times, if you look at historically what happens, is that those periods end up by spawning great innovation and thinking outside of the box. And I think whether it's about new products, it's about new target audiences, it's about new distribution, and certainly about communications, it is really about blowing up all the old assumptions, starting from scratch, and being willing to take risks.
But isn't that sometimes hard from a client side? In other words, they're so focused on tradition and the things that had worked in the past, they're afraid to reach out there and try something new.
Yeah, I think that is true. I think we certainly feel lucky in that we have a lot of clients that certainly, I think, have been more willing to take risks, which has been terrific for us. I also think, though, on the one hand, as you say, it can feel risky. But I think as the economic times have gotten worse and worse, companies do start to realize that the risk is probably worth it at a certain point.
Makes sense.
Yeah, we've been fortunate to talk with people like yourself and others from Nike and Starbucks and other innovative companies. And I remember, Ray, you and I posing a similar type question to an executive with Nike, as I recall, and his answer was, I think it's risky not to take risk, mm-hmm. especially in today's environment.
Makes
you know,
sense.
You get left in the dust and while your competitors are out there taking risks. So maybe the bigger risk is not taking a risk. Let's talk a little bit about you talked earlier, Rob, about how innovation can come together with a client, and through working with a client, you come up with great innovative ideas. How does a client nurture an innovative corporate culture, if you will, and open that type of attitude among the rank and file all the way up to the executive offices of a company? I would imagine that'd be a difficult challenge.
Yeah, it's interesting that you ask. We have a practice that we call employee brand engagement, and we've got professionals that are dedicated to that side of the business, where we will go in into client organizations and evaluate what their culture looks like and how it is received by their employees. We've actually done segmentation studies against employee bases and can segment according to how knowledgeable and how well they understand the company, the culture, the products, et cetera, and how enthusiastic they are. And you can, from that, start to understand what the challenges are. And I will say, with all of the companies right now that are going through consolidations, mergers, acquisitions, divestitures, that becomes an incredibly important part of what management at a client company needs to do. Once we understand where the trouble spots are, or how, and if it's more knowledge-based, if it's more sort of attitude-based, we can develop programs and reach out to employees. And we've had some pretty good success in working with clients so that we develop programs that, once executed, we start to really help employees understand why and have greater pride in why they're working for the companies they're working for.
Yeah, that's interesting. I know that at your firm, Strategic Insight is a critical component of the design process. First off, how do you guys at Brand Union acquire strategic insight for your clients?
Yeah, through a number of ways. We have employees that are dedicated to that part of the process, for sure. But just like we say, creative is not really a department, it's a way of life here. The development of insights can often come from anybody working in any department. We do try to take the time. You know, a lot of times when you're in a rush, you'll cut corners, and that is one place where you really can't. So certainly we use all the same techniques that others use, in terms of basic market research, secondary research, syndicated research, and things that are out there. We do have a number of proprietary techniques that we use to synthesize all of the learnings and to try to figure it out. And I will say, one of the things that we're proud of is we do not feel that we have to own it all ourselves. We have affiliations with professors from Harvard Business School, with MIT, my alma mater, where we are reaching out to academia, we're reaching out to specialists. We will comprise panels of experts and get anthropologists and sociologists in, industry experts. There's no pride of ownership. We are absolutely out there scrambling, trying to get the best information we possibly can in every instance possible.
You know, I think that's so smart. Today, many companies want to sell. They have some kind of proprietary method of gaining consumer insight. But the truth is that I don't think there's a one size fits all in that area. I'm going to give you a chance to maybe get a raise, or you can't get a promotion at this point unless you take over your chairman's job. But I think we're all aware of the problems banks have been facing lately. Among other things, they're rapidly losing credibility and consumer trust. And on your site, your worldwide chairman, Terry Tyrell, has written a very interesting article called Saving the Banks. Share with us your thoughts, Rob, if you would, on how the banking industry can reestablish their credibility, especially in light of what they've just gone through. And maybe there's something all of our listeners that are, be it on the agency side, branding side, or maybe on the client marketer side, can learn from the banking industry and what they're facing today.
Yeah. You know, I guess there are a couple of ways of looking at it. We do a lot of work in the financial services industry, and it's one that is just personally near and dear to my heart. Because I think, as we had talked earlier, financial services is a very complex industry. It is not easy for banks or financial institutions to market themselves, just given the complexity of different types of target audiences they have, the complexity of the products, how they're distributed, et cetera, highly competitive environment, generally speaking. You know, I think that, and there is all sorts of market research out there, as you say, where consumers in particular have become more skeptical of banks. I do think that there is, from a brand management point of view, a critical need to make sure that the brand that you're creating and communicating is genuine and is true to the values with which you're running your company. And I think in the spirit of experimentation that a lot of times at banks and in other industries as well, you see people try to diverge from that or abandon those things to be a little cooler or hipper or different or whatever, and it doesn't pay off. I think it really is important that you understand your roots and that you're very true to them in terms of how you communicate. Certainly, if you have gone through an event that has created a lot of negative press, there are rules of thumb there that suggest that you need to be open and honest. If you've made a mistake, you need to apologize. You need to explain why it's happened. You need to explain what you're doing to make sure it never happens again. And, you know, the notion of just thinking about in terms of basic human relationships and how you would want to be treated or what you would want to hear, I think apply very much at the brand level.
Very good, and a great way to wrap up this segment in our interview. Rob, it's been a pleasure. Do go to thebrandunion.com to find out more, but Rob Scalia, Chief Executive Officer of the Brand Union North America, it's been fun having you here. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it a lot myself.
On the Advertising Show, Ray Shillings, Brad Forsyth. Well, another segment, we're going to do that for you here in just a moment. Stay right here. Rob Scalia, thank you very much for joining us today here at the Advertising Show. Always good interviews. We seem to find the best guests. I don't know. Seems to always work out that way. Here's something else that we hope will work out, and we really have nothing to do with this. It's September 20th for the debut of the brand new Hawaii 5.0. Okay? It's an effort that is really, really, really being pushed by CBS. To the point of almost over-pushing it when they report the football thing here on CBS. It's they'll describe a play on the 5-0-yard line. Not to mention the fact that have we forgotten about the shows called Hawaii, Hawaiian Eye, Hawaiian Heat. I never heard of Hawaiian Heat. Hawaii 5-0 appeared on CBS 68 to 80, 1968 to 1980. Bookham Dano was the thing on Monday, September 20th. CBS brings it back and hopes that the folks who remember it come back and tune it in. Research by CBS, Brad, listen to this, said that 70% of the people over 35 were familiar with Hawaii 5-0, while 70% of the people under 35 were not. But of the people not familiar, they knew the song, which was by the group called The Ventures. So let's hope that let's hope that, you know, things really pick up for this brand new show. There's a 5-day, 45-hour marathon interspersed with previews of the new version. So all in all, along with General Motors and Hawaiian Airlines, they're hoping to push this thing to be a big win. So that'll be kind of cool to have Hawaii 5-0 back, you know?
Yeah, and supposedly they updated the song, but to me, and I've seen a promo or two on it, it sounds like the same song. It's got to be close, and I think they were smart to stay close with the original song.
Oh, gosh, yes, absolutely. We are out of time. Alex Ben Block joins us this coming week for the advertising show. Alex is a regular. He is the entertainment editor. What is it? The Hollywood Reporter? Is that what it is? He is just a blast to have on every time we do. And he'll bring us up to date on everything, probably from the Emmys all the way on to what's cooking. And maybe we'll have a perspective about Hawaii 5-0 as well. We know Alex will. So thanks for joining us today. Thanks again to Rob Scalia with the Brand Union. And we'd like to thank you for tuning in as well here at the Advertising Show, which is being sponsored by Advertising Age Magazine. You can visit them online at adage.com. And real important here, throughout the week, go visit our site as well and tell your friends about it, too. The Advertising Show is a copyrighted Big Radio Midgets production.
Under pressure? Get creative concepts fast. Run a global pitch on openad.net and gain access to a global brain trust of nearly 11,000 advertising and marketing creators from 125 countries. Simply take 15 minutes to fill out our online brief form and we'll take care of the rest. From world-class agencies to the best independents to the brightest freelancers, openad.net global creatives can deliver creative concepts direct to your desktop in a matter of days. Why not save time, energy, and money by quickly sourcing concepts from the world's brightest creative minds? Visit openad.net and see how we're revolutionizing the way ideas are created and traded. It's simple, it's fast, and it's global. Openad.net, the smarter way to create your advertising from the freshest creative minds on the planet. Visit openad.net today to find out more.